Welcome to the Republican Professor Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It is Thursday, 24 October, 2024, years after Jesus. We have again Theological Ethics, Volume 2, Politics by our good friend Helmut Thielicke. Longtime professor at the University of Hamburg in West Germany, back when Germany was split between socialist communists on the one hand, who went with the brutal, murderous dictator Stalin after World War II, and West Germany, which was more friendly to the forces that eventually defeated the Soviet Union, and allied with Ronald Reagan in tearing down the Berlin Wall. So Helmut Thielicke, as you recall, is a highly educated Christian scholar who thought deeply about politics. He watched the National Socialists on the left take over. Then he watched them get defeated by the United States, allied as we were with Stalin. And then Stalin took eastern part of Germany, which included Berlin, and that became a communistic socialist, basically part of the satellite countries in the empire of the imperialistic Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, which was responsible for tens of millions of people essentially being murdered at the hands of an unaccountable, unelected, unelectable government, which was acting, in its own words, on behalf of the people as a dictator of the proletariat, dictator over the proletariat is probably the better way to put it. As Margaret Thatcher said, we all know when people say, socialists say, power to the people, what they really mean is power over people, power to the state over people. So Helmut Thielicke watched both kinds of socialism, both on the left. Socialism is a left-wing phenomenon. And when you zoom in, you might say that the one's more to the right relative to the other. Maybe. If you zoom way in and you don't look at anything else, but if you common sense zoom out, they're both on the left. Both socialism, national socialism, and communistic socialism are on the left. And they're not, they do not recognize separation of powers as the American ethnic identity does, our political identity. And I don't mean ethnic identity in terms of race or color. There's nothing about race in the US Constitution or color. Indian tribes are mentioned. The issue there is loyalty. Loyalty and taxation. Of course, slaves are also mentioned, not as slaves, they're mentioned as persons. And the birth of the Republican Party took that language of personhood seriously and abolished slavery. And here we are on the Republican Professor podcast. We're for separation of powers. We're for the American political ethnic identity of separation of powers and US constitutionalism. We're for the Declaration of Independence, which says that all men are created equal, and that word man is gender neutral. You can look up online, it's there. 1828, Noah Webster's dictionary. It's one of the earliest American dictionaries. Look up the word man. While you're at it, look up the word marriage and have fun with that. The word man, the first definition is gender neutral. The examples that are given in Noah Webster are from Genesis. Male and female, he created them. He created man in his own image. Male and female, he created them. It's explicitly gender neutral. And of course, it's gender neutral in the US Constitution as well. So when you get to Article 2, Clause 1, Section 1 of Clause 1, Clause 1 of Section 1, Article 2 created the presidency. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, period. The next word is he. He. Hillary Clinton didn't think that that needed to be revised when she was running. There was no calls for a constitutional amendment to clarify he, put he and she or they, he is singular. Thank you very much. And it's gender neutral in the Noah Webster sense of 1828, man, the first type, the primary definition referring to mankind. Well, there's a lot there. Helmut Thielicke, it's amazing. I didn't used to have to describe all this, but apparently we have to describe all this because people don't know history. They don't know the English language. They don't know anything about the Constitution, and they don't know anything about Nazist socialism and communistic socialism and what they had in common. Yes, they fought against each other. Yes, just like the North fought against the South in the United States, just like Protestants fought against Catholics, just like Indian tribes fought against each other all the time and wiped each other out. And the stronger Indian tribes survived and the weaker ones died out, like the Karankawas. Where are they? Where are the Cahuiltecans? They died out. The Comanches moved in, and that's as old as time. It's as old as history. It's as prehistory, right? Because they didn't write anything down. Well, Helmut Thielicke is over there, our friend here, and he thought deeply about ideology, what he's calling ideology, because he saw it. He saw it with the Nazis. He saw it with the communists. And we see it today in the United States. This section is on page 39. We're just continuing on. It's called Science and Ideology. Science and Ideology. For all these reasons, we need not be surprised. Indeed, we have already suggested. We're going to make a fair use of this material. We're doing a transformative reading, and we thank Fortress Press for making this available. Go to fortresspress.com. You can purchase this book. You should purchase this book. See their other options for purchase. For example, one of my favorites is Jesus and the Victory of God by N.T. Wright, also New Testament and the People of God. But there's lots of great stuff by Fortress Press. Thanks, Fortress. Thank you, Fortress Press, for making this available. Okay. Now we're going to do a transformative reading. I'm going to have social commentary, obviously, as we go along. For all these reasons, we need not be surprised. Indeed, we have already suggested that the pragmatic tendency is the true center and driving force of ideology, which affects or swallows up all other norms. Pragmatic tendency. That's against the correspondence theory of truth. It's the pragmatic view of truth, which says we don't need to worry about correspondence to reality. We don't need to worry about reality at all, just what works, what gives us power. It will have to suffice if we give only a few examples of this, examples taken from the spheres of science, which being exact might seem to be secure against ideological influence, and of law. Though the axioms of ideology are used even to take issue with Einstein's theory of relativity, the demand that science provide arguments to validate ideological interests is most clearly illustrated in the field of biology. The genetics founded by I.V. Michurin, I don't know how to say that name, sorry, Michurin, and worked out by T.D. Lysenko, teaches the inheritance of acquired characteristics. He's got a. Okay. Alteration of the environmental conditions offers man the possibility of affecting a change in the organism, which can be passed on by inheritance to its descendants. And he's got a footnote there, Gustav A. Wetter, Dialectical Materialism, A Historical and Systematic Survey of Philosophy in the Soviet Union, New York, Prager, 1958. This thesis necessarily lends support in three ways to the axioms of the presupposed ideology. First, it presents man as the lord of nature who has to alter the world in the sense of the thesis which Marx maintained against Feuerbach. Here one thinks of the countless abortions performed, especially in the early years of the Soviet Union. And you're thinking, oh, no, you didn't. You didn't mention abortion. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Second, it gives biological support to the Marxist theory of environment, where man is a product of his social milieu and accordingly has socially acquired characteristics. The logical conclusion, and by altering his environment, man alters himself, is here carried over into the sphere of biology. Plants and animals can be changed by changing their environmental conditions. The characteristics thus derived are determinative of their very nature. That these changes go to the very roots of their nature and are thus genuine, quote unquote, genuine, is proved by the fact that the characteristics thus acquired are actually transmitted. For only that which is of the essence is transmitted hereditarily. One's environment is thus determinative of what one is. Now that's interesting. These leftists, this is what the leftists are saying. This is ideology and science, right? It's basically a rejection of essentialism. It's rejecting that there's an essence of what things are inherent in them, irrespective of the environment, that the environment is what really determines what the thing is. One thinks of gender. This is a very popular view, or now marriage and gender. When the so-called marriage equality advocates were screaming loudly about 15 years ago, stamping their feet, insisting they didn't want to change the definition of marriage while they were insisting to change the definition of marriage. And calling everybody who disagreed with them names like homophobe and hateful and stuff, and saying stuff like no hate, no H8 during the Prop 8 thing here, which really meant no disagreement with me, although I can disagree with you. That kind of hate is fine. There was nobody back then that was aware. Or if they were aware, they were lying about it. But I don't even think they were aware that their movement entailed within it a redefinition not only of marriage and the word hate, but also a redefinition of man and woman. And that came really fast after the Supreme Court unilaterally and inorganically decided in a top-down fashion to try to make people talk differently using the term marriage in the United States. And now we see that effort with social pressure and top-down pressure, government pressure to force people to use the word man and woman differently than what you see in the dictionary in 2015, you know. Let alone 1828. And so it kind of goes along with what he's saying here, is that these leftists think that they can just, these kind of changes are, quote, genuine. Because if you change the environment, you change people. The changes in environment change people because there's no essence to a species, or there's no essence to a sex or a gender. There's no essence to marriage. Third, support is given to the axioms of the ideology when nature and history are treated as if they were analogous. This is possibly only because the doctrine of historical materialism already applies to the history and methods of physical science, though a very dubious physical science. History is not thought to be played out in the sphere of personal decision, where man is a personal subject. It is derived rather from a material base. Accordingly, physical analogies, such as the inversion of quantity into quality, are constantly adduced, for example, in explaining the revolution. Similarly, history can be foretold as surely as a lunar eclipse. He's talking about Marxists here. Since science has to confirm ideology, science too becomes an instrument of power. I'm going to read that again. Pay attention. Since science has to confirm ideology under the socialists, science too becomes an instrument of the power conflict in exactly the same pragmatic sense as ideology itself. Hence, it is easy to detect in the pertinent Soviet writings not so much joy in the attainment of knowledge as joy in the practical usefulness of this knowledge. In other words, joy in applied science. Whereas Einstein could describe the impulse behind research as divine curiosity, Lysenko would presumably say that his motive is to serve the Soviet Union and the class it represents. In other words, a dictatorship. More important, I'm on page 41. More important, therefore, than the genetic discovery of Michurin is the fact that it could be used to produce bigger crops, extend arable acreage, and in the future, perhaps even propagate a new race of supermen. Hence, the scientist is not just one who discovers the processes of nature, he is a quote, frontline fighter for the Soviet Union and its allies, unquote. In his own way, he aims to breach the front lines of monopolistic bourgeois capitalism. The primary task with respect to nature, as with respect to history, is therefore not to understand it, but to change it. That's very important. I'm going to read it again. Pay close attention. Okay. Pay attention. Snapping. Yes, I'm giving you the snap. The primary task with respect to nature, nature is the object of what science studies. As with respect to history, and the past is the object that history studies. Primary task with respect to nature, that is truth about nature, correspondence theory of truth, right? Common sense. History, the past, the truth about the past. That's what history is supposed to tell you, the truth, right? Science is supposed to tell you the truth about nature. History is supposed to tell you the truth about the past. That's why we did the correspondence theory of truth, because what is truth? Commonsensically, it's what is the case? What is the case about the past? What is the case about nature? That's what science is supposed to get at. That's what history is supposed to get at. Here's Tilica. The primary task with respect to nature, according to these ideologues, the socialists, as with respect to history, is therefore not to understand it, but to change it. It's all about power. To change it, you got to have power. Statements concerning nature and history are perfectly interchangeable. The distinction between them fades when man is no longer a free personal subject. Basically, nature and history both represent instances of material changes. Material change. These slogans and the terminological connecting of science, scientific, and political positions, which are all so highly repugnant to a man of the West, are in no sense inarticulate cries. Even on the lips of minor officials, they are the distant echoes of a basic doctrine, which in its origins, even though already a slogan and a dogma, is nonetheless wrapped up in a sublime intellectuality. If this pragmatism is to be discerned already in the quote green wood unquote of the physical sciences, one may expect that in the social sciences, humanities and other disciplines, with their greater immediacy to man and to history, it will be found on an incomparably greater scale. I would add the medical sciences as well, as the last 4 years have taught us. We shall restrict ourselves to a few comments on the relation of ideology and law. I'm laughing because this is a pretty short section. It's only really 2 pages. The ideology on law is twice as long. And he says, I shall restrict myself. So, what is he saying there about ideology and science? Well, basically, he's saying that there's a bifurcation in the mind of the socialist, either the totalitarian. There's a bifurcation between truth, commonsensically understood as the correspondence between a statement and reality. See that previous episode on the correspondence theory of truth. Drop your questions in the comments. A bifurcation between truth and science. A bifurcation between truth and history. A bifurcation between truth and politics. The socialists are not interested in truth. They're interested in what works to give them power. So they're not excited in doing science to find out how the world is. They want to change the world. They're not interested in understanding the world. There's nothing there to understand. That's there as an essence. Rather, it's pragmatic all the way down. They want to change the world and change how? In a way that gives the dictatorship of the proletariat, in the case of the Soviets, more power, or the totalitarian government of the National Socialists, in the case of the Nazis, or fascists. And so the leftist has this way of being pragmatic because they want to change. Their obsession is with change, and not just change, control. They don't like change just for change's sake. They want to control the economy. They want to control public health and what businesses are allowed to do during public health or what individuals are allowed to do. They want to control churches. Control whether you have a mask on your face in an airplane. Control whether the bookstore which poses no threat to anybody in public health, is stays open while Walmart is open. Where the bookstore goes closed while Walmart is open. They want to control winners and losers in the economy. So Amazon winner, Half Off Books in Fullerton, a humble family-run used bookstore, closed. Even though it would be great for you to have an ability to look at a book before you buy it, which you can't do on Amazon. I mean, you can look at a picture, but oftentimes the picture is not really what you get. And across the street, you could get a decaf coffee to go. That was open, but you couldn't get a used book to read while you're sitting at home, not able to go to work and support the used bookstore. As if the used bookstore are just a bunch of royalty just sitting around collecting their trust funds. You know, they were barely making it. And decaf coffee, really? I mean, we actually said that was essential. While things enumerated in the Constitution, like buying guns, buying arms, which is enumerated right in the Constitution, that was inessential. That's a totalitarian way of thinking. That's what he's talking about. They don't care about truth. They were using science in a way to advance their power. By the way, it was primarily Republican judges pushing back against that. It should have been Donald Trump in the White House pushing back by firing Dr. Fauci. He should have fired him. It should have been Republican governors like Abbott in Texas right away, seeing right through that bullcrap. So Republicans made a lot of mistakes, but they didn't make as many mistakes and for as long as the Democrats. So, yeah, I say that because I care about truth here on the Republican Professor podcast. And you have to say that because I believe in separation of powers. I believe in separation of powers in the Electoral College because I have a view of mankind that we're all fallen. We fall short of the glory of God. We're all sinners. Someone comes up to Jesus in the gospel and says, good teacher, and he says, why are you calling me good? There's only one person good. God is good. Only God is good. Why are you calling me good? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. There is no righteous, not one. We are all sinners. We have a sinful nature. That doesn't mean everything we do is good. We're also divinely created in the image of God. We are bearers of rights and responsibilities. And we have common grace. God allows us many things, many enjoyments. So we have a mixed bag here, and that means that the founders believed that. The framers of the Constitution saw that. And so what they did was they wanted to separate powers to make it as hard as possible for power to accumulate into the hands of sinful men. Madison said if men were angels, no government would be necessary. What he means by that, I think, is that the angels are not fallen angels. He means if we were beings that were not sinful by nature, we wouldn't need government. But we do. We need government, but we also need to ensure the government is accountable. Not just that individuals are accountable, but the government itself is controlled by the governed. So there are these checks and balances, and there are separation of powers. And checks and balances and separation of powers are not the same thing. Separation of powers protects individual liberty. The Electoral College does the same thing because it breaks up the principle of simple majority rule, simple majority executive power in the presidency, where essentially the cities would be running the whole place. And it gives it spreads some power over the decision making of a passionate bare majority, gives it more time to reflect and be reasonable, because it gives rural areas a lot of say on who's president, not just the cities. And it's very important. We saw a lot of people moving out of cities into rural areas during the last 4 years and coming to have a greater appreciation for rural common sense thinking, because people in rural areas think differently about the world. They have different assumptions about the world. They think of things that people in cities don't think about, like being prepared for a disaster and being responsible for your neighbor, helping people, being a good neighbor. Also, being suspicious of danger and being ready to confront it. There's a lot of great things about rural areas. There's been a lot of evil too. There's a lot of evil in cities, and there's a lot of great things about cities. We need both. And that's what the Electoral College really protects, is that both have a say, that there's an incredible diversity, not only in terms of race and gender, and well, I wouldn't say gender is a diversity issue, because there's only two genders, in my view, male and female. And I take that from the English language, and I take that from scripture as a Christian. But I think Christianity just teaches the natural law on that, and am I wrong on that? I don't think so. I think that that corresponds to reality, so I'm going to say it. It doesn't give me any more power to say it. In fact, it just makes some people mad when you say that, but it's true. It's still true. The Electoral College appreciates geographical diversity by incorporating the minority, that is the rural, into the decision of who's president. It's enormously important. It's enormously important insight. Okay. Only people in cities don't understand this, but you got to get out of the city. And that's one of the good things about the last 4 years, is people didn't, well, they lost their, the cities lost their luster. And I just hope these people going out into rural areas don't forget it. Don't forget what they learn. When you go out into a rural area, pay attention, learn. I really think that people in New Mexico don't learn. There's some kind of blockage there. New Mexico's an incredibly rural area, but there's a lot of blue people that are from cities, and they don't learn. It's like people in Aspen. It's like they're still urban people, even though they live outdoors. They have that totalitarian way of thinking. A lot of them do. Sad. Anyway, we need the Electoral College. We need separation of powers. We need science to be a set of disciplines which takes nature as the object of its study to find truth. We need history to be that set of disciplines which takes the past as the object of its study to find truth, not just to find what's useful for our power. Thank you for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. It's never been more important to support the work of the podcast. Please go to Venmo. We're on Venmo at the Republican Professor. You can also go to Buy Me a Coffee And it's my name, Lucas J. Mather. Buy me a coffee if you want a small donation. It's an easy way to do it. You can do it anonymously. Some people don't do it anonymously. I don't know why, but their name is there to see, for anybody to see. But I would pr appreciate it. It helps me. Every cent goes far. To be honest with you, I won't use it to buy a cup of coffee. I would not waste it. Nothing against people who run coffee shops. I used to spend a lot of money at coffee shops, but now I just have to penny pinch because it's Biden. Biden times. We're riding with Biden. And gas is too expensive. And I probably would use it to buy a book that I would feature on the podcast, or I would use it for other expenses, like keeping the website up. So please support the podcast. I really do use every penny, and we really appreciate it. We're reaching out to high schoolers across the country. If you're in high school, welcome. I'm going to try to make this as easy for you to understand as possible. All right, take care, guys.